One tribe, one kind, one planet, one race. It's all one blood, don't care about your face, color of your eye, or the tone of your skin. Don't care where you are, don't care where you been, cause where we gonna go is where we wanna be. The place where the native language is unity.
We live in an era where Elon Musk controls Twitter, where Tucker Carlson is the king of cable, and where 27-year-old Sophie Barron is a unifier. She's the founder of The Conversationalist, an online platform for Gen Z. The Conversationalist brings young people together to have civil discussions on controversial topics. It's a compelling concept, but it's altogether rare.
Confessori concludes that Carlson has constructed what may be the most racist show in the history of cable news.
The head alien is a supernaturally strange being called Kamala Harris.
And by some measures, the most successful.
Sophie Barron is swimming upstream in these discordant times. But she's built a place where Gen Zers with different perspectives find refuge from the prevailing nastiness, where they can disagree without being disagreeable, where echo chambers and algorithms break down, where people on all sides of issues talk to each other.
Man, I'm loving this peace. Man, I'm loving this peace. Man, I'm loving this peace.
From the Stanford Center on Longevity, this is Century Live, The Next 50. I'm your host, Ken Stern. Today we continue our series on leaders in their 20s and 30s. They tell us what they've learned from previous generations, how they work to improve the world they've inherited, and how they imagine their supersized futures will unfold. I sat down with Sophie to ask, how exactly does the conversationalist work?
I liken this analogy, Ken, to a salad, if you will.
I am unfamiliar with salads.
Oh, Ken,
can you analogize it to a cheeseburger for me?
Sadly not, but I love a good cheeseburger. I think oftentimes people mistake the work that I do for a soup. They think, okay, I'm bringing all of these viewpoints together, all of these people together, and blending them into one whole. But the issue with that thinking is that in a soup, for the most part, you lose every sense of the individual component that went into that mixture. And the work that I'm doing, I think, is better understood through a salad. We are bringing the vibrancy of every ingredient and every person, every perspective, opinion, lived experience to the same bowl so that we can even see the other ingredients and perhaps a bite with multiple ingredients that have all retained their original shape are better than just eating a bowl of tomatoes or cucumbers on their own. And people will still want to eat the ingredients separately, but you could argue salads are good for our overall health, and I believe that to be true as a society. And I want people to understand that coming together doesn't mean you have to accept every person's view, but I think it's accepting a reality that every single person comes from a different background or experience outside of your own. And if we can understand that, then we can even start to conceive of a solution to the problems we see. Ooh, thank you for coming to my TED Talk on salads, Ken.
We'll draw millions. I've heard you refer to yourself as the only Jewish kid in your school. Tell us about how that experience led to your current life.
Growing up in Wichita, Kansas, I think looking back on it, I received a lot of the values that I prioritize today from growing up in the Midwest. But as you mentioned, being the only Jewish student in my grade throughout all of school growing up was definitely challenging at times. I wanted to fit in. I did not want to be a Fruit Loop in a world of Cheerios. I just wanted to conform. But no matter how much I wanted to fit in, I still stuck out. And it came up in small moments, either in the form of being the butt of the joke, or when it was a Jewish high holiday, missing school and people not understanding, or even in the ways in which my classmates understood me. They had never really interacted with a Jewish individual before. And so in some ways, I think I felt a lot of pressure, and it was definitely challenging. And for so long, I wanted to be surrounded by other Jewish kids. And I'm so happy that my parents sent me away to Jewish summer camp, because it showed me a world where there were other Jewish kids out there. But then I'd come back at the end of the summer feeling out of place. And so that disconnect definitely fueled some of the work that I do now.
So draw that line between those experiences of maybe being the other. Tell us about your work now and how you got from here to there.
So when it came time for college application season, Ken, I quite literally sprinted down the yellow brick road from Kansas all the way to Philadelphia. And as soon as I got to campus at Penn, I did what anyone would, which is try to find your friends, try to belong. And for me, it was the first time I was surrounded by other Jewish students. So I joined every Jewish club under the sun, the Jewish a cappella group. I was involved with Penn Hillel. I was in the Jewish sorority. I found a Jewish boyfriend. My parents were ecstatic. And one day I was walking through campus in my freshman year, and I had this aha moment where I realized that as I was surrounded by all of the Jewish students on campus, everyone else was surrounding themselves with people of their own identity groups. And I couldn't quite understand why we came to college to interact with people of all walks of life, but then self-selected into like-minded circles. And this brought me back to my upbringing in Wichita, where I, for the first time, realized that I had been taking for granted everything that I experienced growing up. I thought that in order to belong and to be happy, we had to be surrounded by people who were like us, when in fact, I got so much more out of my experience growing up in Wichita, being surrounded by people who were completely different from me. And this is when I felt some agency over that experience to do something about it. And fast forward to the 2016 election at Penn, and no one wanted to even interact with you if you were doing anything other than voting for Hillary. And in that moment, I decided to use my voice. I put pen to paper and I wrote an article, a manifesto, encouraging my generation to break out of their own echo chambers. And that turned into an article that was published in the Huffington Post, and long story short, was the spark behind The Conversationalist today.
So how do you mediate, how does The Conversationalist mediate differences? How do you put someone who's pro-life and pro-choice in the same room and not have them instantly be suspicious of the motives or the values of the other?
The beauty of creating our own space, independent of social media, has allowed us to really create our ideal community with the same fundamental principles to meet one another with mutual respect and to share what we allow and what we don't allow on our platform. And in platforming those principles, we've created this set of 10 commandments that are so sacred to our community. So when we host these conversations, people enter knowing that that is what is required in order to participate in them. I think oftentimes we bring people to the table with the desire to talk. And I think once we get people there, then we can start to educate and guide people through the process of becoming someone who can be coined as a conversationalist. So often we enter conversations with the intention of changing someone's mind, when in fact we're trying to reinvent the notion of conversation to be one of understanding, learning, and listening with the intention to better understand someone's point of view and seek to open that mind instead of change it. I will say at the same time, there will always be people who do not want to practice these principles, but oftentimes I view that as someone not being ready, because there might be someone who isn't comfortable opening their echo chamber or isn't ready to have that difficult conversation in a way that's productive. And we always say, great, you do not need to be here. We are not for everyone as much as we want to be, but we will be here when you are ready.
So tell me a story. I love stories of when you struggled with someone who wasn't ready and what you learned from that experience.
This is a story about an individual who wanted to be a part of our community. This individual, who shall not be named, had very fervent beliefs that men are superior to women and would continue to share facts and figures that they felt were real that proved that women are inherently inferior to men and therefore should be treated as such, including figures around how men biologically are better at math, and had all of these instances in proving that women should remain silent and should stay, quote unquote, in their place, whether that be in the home or in the kitchen. And this was an interesting scenario for us as a brand, because we value free speech. We wanted to get to the bottom of why that person felt the way that they did. And we wanted to do everything we could to have that person better share their viewpoints in a way that could open up conversation, but they were not interested. They only wanted to hear viewpoints that agreed with their own, and they only wanted to share what they believed in. And through numerous conversations with this individual, we had to make the decision that for the sake and the health of the community, to remove that individual with the premise that they were not ready to truly be a part of our work. They were not committed to meeting others at the table. They wanted their own table. So to this day, I still get sad when I think about it, because those are the people who I believe need this work the most.
Would you have let him stay if he had been open to hearing from others and respectful of others, even if the other 99.9% of your community was like, that's really gross?
I think it depends on the content of his questions. And I shouldn't say, I didn't want to give away the fact that it was a him, but I guess we will go with that.
I feel pretty confident that someone arguing that men are better than women is probably going to be a guy.
Sure.
I'll take that leap.
Although it would upset people, if he were able to present his views in a way that truly allowed for dialogue and was not asserting his views on the entire community in a way that made them feel attacked, absolutely, I would have loved for him to still be a part of the community.
Sophie, I'm interested in the challenge of dealing with what's called the big sort, how we stick ourselves in our own cones of silence, as I like to think about them. What have you learned about the sort of openness of your generation to say, hey, maybe the other side is not all that different from us?
I've learned that Gen Z in particular is incredibly open to dialogue. And oftentimes, as our society gets more and more polarized, it's harder to believe that the person next to you or across the way could be interested in having that dialogue with you. But I think we've forgotten to ask. And I've been so pleasantly surprised to learn that Generation Z oftentimes can find common ground in the most unlikely of ways. Or if common ground is not to be uncovered, the common ground for our generation is the future that we're trying to create. Gen Z may see the same future and agree on some of the core tenets of a particular issue, but maybe differentiate the pathways to get there and get to that solution. So I've definitely become and remained an optimist that our generation will be the generation to bring us back to the same table.
How does that play out? I mean, tell us about a conversation there that sort of means something to you just as a person.
Yeah. I convened a panel of four Gen Zers who fell on the right when it came to climate change and issues of the climate crisis, and four who stood on the left. And we had an open dialogue around the environment and where we could potentially come together, where their differences were. And I remember studying and prepping for that interview, thinking it was going to be one of the most heated conversations to date. And I ended up being so pleasantly surprised that every single person on the panel agreed that climate change existed, agreed on the issue itself, but had different pathways by which we should solve the climate crisis. And I think I was incredibly hopeful that there would be conversations like that, but it wasn't until that conversation that I realized that young people actually do have a lot of common ground that I think has yet to be uncovered. And that will always stick with me as one of the first times where I really saw unity in action, and I couldn't believe that it was on the issue of climate change.
You're an entrepreneur, so you must think about the future, at least for the conversationalist, and what success could look like and what failure might look like. So tell us your hopes and your fears.
I think there's so much on our shoulders as young people to reconcile in the present that I think for a lot of factors, I tend to block out the future because it's not always certain. I will say I have high hopes that the conversationalist will be able to not only remain as a talk show or an organization, but rather a movement. But I have to hold on to the notion that I really believe that what I'm building is bigger than myself. We're not forcing everyone to hold hands and kumbaya and completely compromise our viewpoints in order to stand as one people. I don't think that's realistic. What I am trying to ask of our world and of our generation is to simply open our minds to someone else's point of view and rid ourselves of these political parties and labels that I know our generation rejects, and see one another as human beings who are all products of our unique lived experiences. And if we can understand where someone else is coming from, that understanding can lead to echo chambers breaking down. So that is my hope for the future, for the conversationalists, that we can continue to empower Gen Z to foster these skills that we're teaching at the conversationalist, so we can bring the world back together.
I hope you're right. You're an optimist, and I think to be an entrepreneur, you have to be an optimist. I feel a little weighted down by despair sometimes, but I hope you're right. Let's catch amnesia. Forget about all that evil. Forget about all that evil.
That evil that they feed you. Let's catch amnesia. All right, Sophie, last question for you. The pharaohs, as I understand it, used to be buried with things that they wanted to take with them to the afterlife. So let's just assume that that actually worked. Is there anything you would want to be buried with that you'd want to carry into your afterlife?
I would hope that I would be buried with the ring that I wear around my finger every day. And this is a ring that I have inscribed in Hebrew that says, the moment when you realize the rest of the world doesn't think like you, that's when you grow. And I think that's something that has guided my entire life, my upbringing, my college years, the work that I do now with the conversationalist. And so much of the fabric of who I am as a person is a unifier. And I feel like I was put on this earth to bring people together. So I hope that that is included in where I will spend eternity.
That's a beautiful answer. One tribe, y'all. One tribe, y'all.
One tribe, y'all. We are one people. That's Sophie Barron of The Conversationalist. You can learn more at theconversationalist.com. In our next episode, coming in 2 weeks, we explore water equity and inequity through the eyes of a scientist who helped expose the Flint water crisis. The producers of Century Lives are Carrie Thompson and Aaron Bump. Music for the episode is from the Black Eyed Peas and TED. Century Lives is a production of the Stanford Center on Longevity, where our mission is to support ideas and research so that century-long lives are healthy and rewarding ones. You can find out more about us at longevity.stanford.edu. Support for Century Lives comes from the James A. Johnson Longevity Prize for Excellence in Media, recognizing journalism and entertainment that addresses the dramatic increase in life expectancy in the last century. I'm Ken Stern. Thanks for listening.